The United Nations Children's Fund warns that some 1 million Afghan children facing severe acute malnutrition could die this year without immediate action. The agency added children in Afghanistan are also at risk of contracting diseases including measles and diarrhea that have exacerbated the situation for them. UNICEF has called for an immediate resumption of vaccination campaigns against polio, measles and COVID-19 in Afghanistan. The UN has repeatedly raised the alarm about a potential humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan in recent weeks, calling on donor nations to honor their financial pledges. Life in Kabul, as well as the face of the city, has changed during the 8 weeks since the Taliban assumed power in the Afghan capital. Our correspondent, Rahmatullah Baghban, has more.
Following the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, now the Taliban are rolling over Kabul and other cities and provinces across the nation. New messages painted on the walls in the city center are a reminder of visible changes. Our nation has, with the help of God, defeated America. One of the new Taliban slogans reads, replacing the previous colorful painting. The Afghan flag has largely been replaced with the white Islamic Emirate emblem, with many selling the new banners amid heavy traffic across the city.
After the Taliban takeover, I started selling the Taliban's flags and slogans. It is a good business for me. Many Taliban soldiers and their followers buy and display them on the cars, motorbikes and houses. I make good money and it is getting better day by day.
Another challenging change, the level of poverty is rising. Women are selling their gold to get some cash to support their families. Many have lost their jobs, with some struggling to make food for their family. Others are selling household items to make ends meet.
I've brought my household items for sale because there are no jobs. What should we do for a living? I asked the Taliban to create jobs. They must prepare the ground for us to work. Today we are selling household items. What should we do tomorrow?
The most obvious change is the presence of Taliban members themselves. The Taliban are seen roaming the city, guns flung over their shoulders. Some are wearing uniforms and some are in local clothes. And another change, many women are seen to be staying off the streets, but some are seen in longer coats and headscarves and some in the all-covering burqa. Fewer men are seen wearing Western dress as they have switched to local clothes. The Taliban takeover changed the face of capital Kabul in many ways. The nation's already flagging economy is collapsing and creeping chaos is in the making. It remains to be seen what future holds for the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Vote counting is underway in Iraq as polling stations close in the country's parliamentary elections. Preliminary results are expected on Monday. Nearly 25 million people were eligible to cast their ballots. Around 3,500 candidates competed to enter the 329-seat parliament. Candidates include around 1,000 women. The election was the fifth parliamentary vote in Iraq since former dictator Saddam Hussein was ousted in 2003. Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, called for a large voter turnout. Security has been tightened, with all airports closed until Monday morning nationwide. Voters said they hoped the elections would bring change.
Today, we came to participate in the elections, my family and I, so that we ask for our demands, the population's demand to have early elections. God willing, our participation in the elections is a new path for Iraq, with new faces that we choose, so that we continue to have ambitions for change.
Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi and resistance leader Qais al-Khazali cast their ballots in Baghdad. This year's election was held under a new electoral law that divides Iraq into 83 constituencies instead of 18. Well, that is meant to help independent candidates, I should be saying. The vote came a year earlier than scheduled in response to protests that broke out in 2019. They called for better public services and an end to corruption and economic woes. Iraqi elections are often followed by months of negotiations over a president, a prime minister, and a cabinet. Palestinian farmers and traders in the Gaza Strip have held a protest at Karm Abu Salem crossing, demanding an end to what they called its suffocating closure by Israel. The crossing serves as the main gate connecting Gazans to the outside world. Ruba Shabit has more.
Karim Abu Salim crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Karim Abu Salim threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector that is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Karim Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Karim Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lost our money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also expressed the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that caused serious financial losses. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The Algerian president says the return of Algeria's ambassador to France is conditional on the total respect for his country. Abdelmajid Tebboune said Algeria is not a French colony any longer, adding that history should not be falsified. Algeria recalled its envoy to Paris last week, citing comments attributed to French President Emmanuel Macron that Algeria's rulers had rewritten the history of its colonization based on, quote, a hatred of France. The following day, Algeria banned French military planes from its airspace amid tensions with Paris. Political commentator Abayomi Azakiwa says that France's policies toward African countries, including Algeria, are still rooted in colonialism.
It's not surprising. It follows a pattern of many people on the African continent that have been criticizing France for the continuation of its legacy of colonialism and enslavement. Just a few weeks ago, Macron had a meeting with some Algerians who had fought alongside Paris during the war for national liberation in Algeria during the 1950s and 60s. And that's where those statements that you quoted earlier were made. So he's suggesting that there was really no Algerian nation prior to the advent of French colonialism way back in 1830. They colonized the country for over 130 years, and during the war between 1954 and 1962, over a million Algerians were killed as a result of the French colonial forces. They have never apologized, they've never offered to pay reparations, and it adds insult to injury for them to suggest that they had committed no colonial crimes in Algeria.
Over 100,000 Poles have demonstrated in support of European Union membership after a court ruled that the Polish constitution overrides some EU laws. People rallied in over 100 towns and cities, as well as in the capital, Warsaw, warning against another Brexit. The recent ruling raised concerns that it could propel Poland into an exit from the bloc. Donald Tusk, leader of the country's biggest opposition party, Civic Platform, and ex-president of the European Council, called on Poles to protest against the ruling. European Commission said the changes have undermined judicial independence and opened up the courts to political interference. In an escalation of row between Poland and the EU, Polish judges rule that national law has primacy over European rules. Now, a huge crowd gathers in the capital of Belgium, Brussels, demanding that world leaders take tougher action to fight climate change. Many of the demonstrators accuse the EU leaders of thuring over the crisis. Jerome Hughes has more.
Thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, the elderly people. We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Eh? Actually, it's this moment. This is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world. And I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are not... don't seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we're going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change the consequences of the past.
Referring to oil and gas, they chanted, "Keep it in the ground." Doing so might be unjustifiable in the context of economic growth and social inclusion, many analysts argue. That's because for decades, the richest countries have become richer through the use of fossil fuels. Now developing nations are being told not to do the same by world powers. These poorer countries are saying, fair enough, but you must compensate us financially. World leaders are being urged to tackle this very issue head on when they meet at the end of the month for a 12-day UN climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In Chile, riot police have clashed with protesters during a rally by the indigenous Mapuche community. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the protesters. Authorities said a woman died, 17 police officers were injured, and 10 protesters were arrested during the clashes. About 1,000 activists marched in the center of Santiago, demanding autonomy for the Mapuche. The Chilean state has long been accused of discrimination against the Mapuche people, the country's largest indigenous group. The community controlled vast areas of Chile centuries ago, but has since been marginalized. China has accused Taiwan of inciting confrontation and distorting facts as tensions escalate over the island's push for independence. Chinese Office for Taiwan Affairs said the island is closing the door to dialogue by seeking independence. The reaction was in response to comments made by Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen. She said the self-ruled island will continue to bolster its military capabilities in the face of what she called Beijing's pressure. Taiwan considers itself a sovereign state, but Beijing views the island as a breakaway province and maintains sovereignty over it under the One China policy. Taiwan's growing military reliance on the U.S. has further fueled the territory's tensions with China. Well, excitement has gripped the Muslim community in London as the capital hosts the biggest Imam Ali exhibit Europe has ever seen. Press TV was invited to visit this new project, which organizers hope will rekindle interest in the life and legacy of one of Islam's most important historical heroes.
London is now hosting the biggest and most expensive Islamic exhibit, which focuses its entire attention to the life and legacy of the cousin and son-in-law of Islam's Holy Prophet Muhammad. The Imam Ali exhibit takes viewers on an interactive journey through the life of Ali ibn Abi Talib, whose loyal service helped create a lasting and perfect religion.
Imam Ali is beloved by all Muslims across the globe. For Sunnis, he's revered as the fourth rightly guided Khalifa, but for Shias, he's the first holy Imam. This exhibit offers an exciting and unique opportunity for the community to reconnect with one of Islam's most important historical figures, but also for viewers to learn more information about the life of this character, including things which may have been forgotten historically.
Run by the Legacy Group, the creators told Press TV they hoped retracing the life of Imam Ali in full will leave visitors with a renewed connection to this Islamic legend.
So we believe that, that Ali ibn Abi Talib is one of the most amazing characters in history. He appeals to a wide audience. He famously said that he's a person that's either your brother in faith or your equal in humanity. His letter to Malik al-Ashtar, which was his governor in Cairo, was referenced by the United Nations as being a reference point for the Arab leaders of the world because he was so adamant on justice, on social equality, on fair governance, on non-corruption. And his life as a leader in 4.5 years epitomized and personified that. So our appeal is to share this information with a global audience to come and visit and to see this place.
The exhibit is clearly a roaring success, with hundreds visiting each opening day. Organizers say that expansion plans are in motion, and they intend to remain open for the foreseeable future, meaning that Imam Ali's legacy continues to inspire even outside of traditional Muslim homelands. Robert Carter, London.
That's it for me for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Many of the same corporations trumpeting their support for black lives are bankrolling police violence via little known but powerful police foundations in cities across the U.S., a new report released recently revealed. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Corporate-Backed Police Foundations Pose Threat to Democracy and Black Lives, a report shows. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Many of the same corporations trumpeting their support for black lives are bankrolling police violence via little-known but powerful police foundations in cities across the U.S., a new report released recently revealed. The racial justice group Color of Change and the Public Accountability Initiative Little Sis published a report entitled Police Foundations, a Corporate-Sponsored Threat to Democracy and Black Lives, which highlights financial ties between police foundations and corporations, including at least 55 Fortune 500 firms. Police foundations, private organizations that funnel donations from companies and outside groups to law enforcement agencies, are protecting corporate interests and enabling state-sanctioned violence against black communities and communities of color, the report notes. It's impossible to separate the role of policing from the role of money, the authors assert. In Georgia, the Atlanta Police Foundation's sponsors include Amazon, Bank of America, Chick-fil-A, Delta Airlines, Home Depot, Waffle House, Wells Fargo, Uber, and UPS, to name but a few. These are donors we know about, the report states. As calls for accountability increase in recent years, police foundations have taken additional steps to scrub their websites and hide donor information. There is a police foundation in nearly every major American city. Behind almost every police department, backed by wealthy donors and giant multinational corporations, the report adds. In 2020, many police foundations' top corporate sponsors made public statements in support of Black Lives Matter while providing a corporate slush fund for police, unquote. After Atlanta police officer Garrett Rolfe was charged with murder for fatally shooting Rayshard Brooks in the back in June 2020, a time when Black Americans were reeling from recent police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, and others, the Atlanta Police Foundation said it would pay every cop in the city a $500 bonus. This, as many of the corporations sustaining the foundation rushed to profess their support for racial justice. The report argues police accountability and corporate accountability are even more inextricably linked than they may appear. We cannot let corporations talk about Black lives on their Twitter feeds while also funding police violence in our streets. Caller of Change President Rashad Robinson said that only cutting ties with police foundations will show that corporate leaders are serious about protecting Black lives and bringing police departments into the 21st century. In the U.S., new companies continue to contribute to police foundations, swelling already bloated law enforcement budgets, funding police militarization, enabling ever-expanding surveillance, and spreading propaganda messaging that fuels fears about crime and promotes the normalization of ever-growing policing. Robinson said corporations bankroll police foundations, and then police foundations use that support to attack common sense reforms, spread misinformation about reformers, and defend the most outdated, violent, and racially biased practices of police officers.
Food for thought.
Since we are passing through the days when Imam Hassan Askari, peace be upon him, the 11th infallible heir of Prophet of Islam, was in a state of agony on being poisoned by the Abbasid Caliph, here is an aphorism from him worth pondering upon. Worship is not abundant fasting and praying, but worship is abundant pondering. It is the continuous remembrance of Allah. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, take counsel to be guided. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Group work always produces synergistic benefits, improvement and development. When many heads come together, their collective experience and knowledge can be tapped to facilitate planning, problem solving, productivity, creativity, and innovation. Those who have become self-opinionated and obstinate often suffer from mistakes and losses. Everyone has unique mental powers, we all know that. Allah has blessed us all with different skill sets, different level of intellect. One mind may produce a brain wave that would never occur to another. When the bright ideas of many minds combine, they would produce a light that can illuminate many and any darkness. Let us all decide to adopt the practice of always consulting with informed and intelligent persons. Imam Hassan, the second infallible Imam, has said, "Nations in which consultation with each other is practiced are always guided to their welfare and benefit." If we look around and if we see the blessings and the barakat of those who are taking counsel, those who are involving other people in group works, taking help from others, utilizing other people's strengths, when it comes to them producing results, it's much, much better and more effective than those who work in isolation. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the importance of taking counsel to be guided. You know, sometimes we become so self-opinionated and so self-centric that we think that everything that we are planning and thinking suffices and is sufficient and is the best that can be done. Well, guess what? This is not how this world is designed. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed us all with different abilities and capabilities. The design is that we all come together to work towards a common goal, a bigger goal. This allows us not only to plan better, not only to be more productive and creative and innovative. In addition to this, it assists and helps us in terms of the distribution of work. The workload for any project, for any task, for any sublime goal is bigger than what we expect it to be. And this is typically what happens when we walk into any field, a field of study it be, or a field of research. We realize that there is so much depth. We need more helping hands. And you see that those who manage to bring other people on board and are ready to work with other people, they end up producing effective results. Otherwise, you know, there's so many things that stay on our wish list, and then the life, it comes to an end. So if we want to deliver something before we leave this world, something in the field of academia or otherwise, we need to be able to, and we need to learn to be able to work with others, use their capabilities, and let our capabilities and abilities be used by others, again, for those righteous goals. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In mid-June, the port city of Prince Rupert in northern British Columbia was the scene of a success by an anti-Israeli movement. A group of activists called Block the Boat formed a picket line to prevent the Israeli Zimbolan's ship from docking. The port workers respected the picket line, and the ship remained unloaded for a day and a half before an emergency court order was issued. A few days later, Dubai Ports World, which handles the specific terminal in Prince Rupert Port, where the Volans had docked, announced that it would suspend the port workers for 3 days for respecting the anti-Israeli picket. The Emirati company overtly backed the Israeli shipping company in the face of a growing pro-Palestinian movement on Canadian soil. Yet there seems to be more stories behind the UAE-Israel-Canada triangle. CBC News has recently revealed that Canada's former Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, heads the advisory committee of AWZ Ventures, a Canadian-based firm focused on Israeli cybersecurity and intelligence technologies.
These technologies that we're discussing are being tested on Palestinians, the Israeli military tests on Palestinians, and that's why Israel's been at cutting edge of all kinds of security intelligence technologies. And two, the Canadian company is going to sell those to the different monarchies, particularly UAE, but probably also Saudi Arabia, to repress their own population. So Canadian company is, you know, with the former prime minister, is going to make money from a mix of repression of Palestinians and repression of those living in the different monarchies in the Middle East.
According to the CBC expose, AWZ Ventures finances Israeli surveillance technology systems, including facial recognition and crowd detection systems, and services that deliver comprehensive information on individuals in real time.
Stephen Harper, the prime minister, the former prime minister, who's the, you know, head of the advisory council of the company, he was a, you know, extremely anti-Palestinian political leader in this country. He's considered to have really shifted Canadian policy in support of Israel in a quite strong way, voting against all the UN resolutions upholding Palestinian rights, deepening military ties between Canada and Israel, justifying, you know, all of Israel's destruction of Gaza in 2014, on and on and on. Canada has a long history of being quite supportive of Zionism, but Stephen Harper really deepened that support, and I think that this Harper's role AWZ Ventures is really just extending that kind of position.
The alarming point in the report is that the firm is involved in facilitating the purchase of these double-edged technologies to the United Arab Emirates, a rich Persian Gulf country with one of the poorest human rights records in the world. In addition to Stephen Harper, AWZ Ventures has former Mossad, CIA, and MI6 senior members on its advisory board.
Oh, I think it's definitely a cause for concern regarding, I mean, this is Canada, every year, Canadian military companies, Canadian government, with Canadian government supporting it, attend a big arms fair in Abu Dhabi, and I think this is sort of extending this process along, where Canadian government is and Canadian companies are providing tools for repression.
What's more, the Canadian-based firm is setting up a new subsidiary in the UAE under the name of AWZ Horizons. It said the company will be run by Catherine Verrier Frechet, who used to be the representative of Canada to the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. While the UAE's easy access to surveillance technologies is disturbing enough, opening a new subsidiary in the country would be really dangerous, as it seeks promoting and facilitating this Israeli technology to other despotic regimes in the region, such as Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. And this is all against what Ottawa claims to be neutrality in its foreign policy, using former diplomats in the cybersecurity business to pave the way for interactions with oppressive regimes is anything but neutrality.
The fact that a former Canadian representative to the Palestinian Authority, Catherine Verrier-Frechet, the fact that she is part of this endeavor in the UAE and spearheading it as the in-country representative in the UAE, that's quite interesting. I think that speaks to her politics and the fact that one element of this relationship between the Canadian company, Israeli Mossad and IDF officials and the UAE is that this is tied to the broader geopolitics going on, where Israel and the UAE are obviously, began diplomatic relations, and there's a whole process of trying to sort of normalize relations with Israel. And this venture, I think, is one, a small little piece in that overarching sort of geopolitical dynamic.
Among other Canadian figures who work for AWZ Ventures are Richard Fadden, former director of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and Stockwell Day, former conservative cabinet minister, who can whitewash these regimes whenever the occasion arises. For example, in one case, Fadden said, "A lot of the technology is useful in fighting terrorism, and that was my main interest. Some of the technology that's been developed helps develop a sense of what's going on the one level on social media, so you can accumulate information." This per se shows that the Canadians are prepared to go to any lengths to work as apologists, both for Israeli products and for despotic clients such as the Arab kings and emirs in the Persian Gulf and beyond. After all, these Arab regimes are notoriously known for using state-of-the-art technologies to suppress any freedom-seeking movement in the region, not for fighting terrorism. The role of Israeli spyware Pegasus in the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi has now been factually proved. By the same spyware, the UAE has targeted many dissidents and journalists at home and abroad.
The UAE is a place that has, some of the least amount of public participation in political life. So it's quite a repressive country, and it will be used. The technologies will be used to deepen that repression. Also, regionally, the UAE has been heavily involved in war in Yemen, in Libya, in Syria. So the UAE is strengthening the monarchy's repressive intelligence, military capacities is also, I think, troubling in terms of from a regional dynamic, because it's a quite belligerent place.
Ironically, even these apologists themselves don't come from a country with an immaculate human rights record. The recent discovery of unmarked graves belonging to indigenous students in Canada is just a case in point. Now, the Abraham Accord, or the confluence of money and technology, facilitated by Western powers such as Canada, is threatening the whole region. And the presence of Israel in Expo Dubai this year for the first time is just marking a new era that can go sinister anytime.
Yes, sir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The frightening point is that all the evidence suggests that the U.S. was able to manipulate the legal processes in both Sweden and the U.K. to engineer Assange effective incarceration all that time and to this day, says Jonathan Cook, writer, in an article titled CIA Plan to Poison Assange Wasn't Needed. U.S. Found Lawful Way to Disappear Him. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. A Yahoo News investigation reveals that through much of 2017, the CIA weighed up whether to use wholly extrajudicial means to deal with the supposed threat posed by Julian Assange and his whistleblower's platform, WikiLeaks. The agency plotted either to kidnap or assassinate him. Shocking as the revelations are, exposing the entirely lawless approach of the main U.S. intelligence agency, the Yahoo investigation nonetheless tends to obscure rather than shine a light on the bigger picture. Assange has not been deprived of his freedom for more than a decade because of an unimplemented rogue operation by the CIA. Rather, he has been held in various forms of captivity, disappeared through the collaborations of various national governments and their intelligence agencies, aided by legal systems and the media that have systematically violated his rights and legal due process. The reality of Assange's years of prosecution is far worse even than the picture of a thuggish, vengeful, power-mad CIA painted by Yahoo reporting. More than 30 former senior officials who either served in the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Agency or the Trump administration helped to piece together for Yahoo the various components of the CIA's plan. They show that the agency considered two main options for dealing with Assange, in addition to then secret moves by laying the groundwork for prosecuting the WikiLeaks founder in the U.S. courts. One plan was to kidnap Assange from Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he had been seeking political asylum since 2012. The aim was to smuggle him to the U.S., violating the sovereignty of the Ecuador and the U.K. in an operation that would have had all the hallmarks of extraordinary rendition. That was the illegal procedure the U.S. used after 9/11 to abduct suspects in the so-called War on Terror. Usually so, they could be sent to black sites, where they were tortured and held without judicial oversight. The other CIA proposal was to assassinate Assange, or perhaps more accurately, commit extrajudicial murder to silence him once and for all. Poisoning him was reportedly one of the methods considered. These scenarios need to be borne in mind when we cast our minds back to 2012, to the moment Assange decided to seek sanctuary in Ecuador's embassy, fearing the wrath of the U.S. at his exposure of his crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Not a single corporate journalist gave credence to his concerns. In fact, they ridiculed them. These latest revelations confirm what was obvious to many of the rest of us. Assange had very good reasons indeed to seek political asylum. Let us examine that bigger picture obscured by the reporting of the CIA's plan. The agency's much greater interest in Assange's case and its more openly hostile attitude towards him were a result of WikiLeaks' release of parts of a cache of secret files on the CIA's hacking capabilities known as Vault 7. The agency, considering it the largest data loss in CIA history, was deeply humiliated by the exposure. The misleading impression created by the Yahoo investigation is that until 2017, a standard legal process was being pursued against Assange that only turned rogue after the Vault 7 release, when the CIA wanted vengeance and to intimidate WikiLeaks to prevent any further leaks. In the words of one Trump national security official, there was an inappropriate level of attention to Assange given the CIA's embarrassment, not the threat he posed in the context. We should never act out of a desire for revenge, unquote. The implication is that because the CIA's various extrajudicial plots were never implemented, justice has otherwise been well served in Assange's case. But the CIA plans indicate something else entirely. They show that once the CIA was infuriated by WikiLeaks' exposure of the agency's own crimes as the Pentagon, the State Department and the White House already were up theirs. It joined them in getting more actively involved in an existing extrajudicial process meant to finish off Assange and WikiLeaks. From the moment Assange's legal troubles began in late 2010, when two Swedish women were reported to have launched allegations of rape, nothing followed the standard procedure. Swedish police, the country's media, and a second prosecutor all meddled in a case the main prosecutor had already ruled did not involve a criminal offense. The testimony of one of the women, who had been encouraged to go to the police by the other, was effectively hijacked and turned into a rape allegation, seemingly against her wishes. Inexplicably, Interpol issued a red notice for Assange arrest, usually reserved for terrorists and dangerous criminals, shortly after Swedish officials had approved his traveling abroad. In the UK, the courts approved an extradition warrant for Assange that had been issued without any Swedish judicial authority. The ruling set such a terrible legal precedent that the agreement on which the extradition was based was amended shortly afterwards to ensure such a ruling could not be made again. Once Assange fled to Ecuador's embassy, the UK government surrounded it with huge numbers of police at great public expense. For a while, government ministers threatened to tear up diplomatic protocols established in by law, sending police in to arrest Assange on foreign soil. A Freedom of Information request shows Britain's prosecution service pressured Swedish prosecutors not to come to London to interview Assange through 2010 and 2011, thereby creating the embassy standoff that began a short time later. Other evidence shows Swedish prosecutors were regularly interviewing the suspects in the UK. Only in Assange's case was that made impossible. British prosecutors destroyed emails relating to Assange to circumvent another FOI request, but the few that survive by mistake show it meddling directly in a case it should have had no legal stake in. In one, a Swedish proposed dropping the investigation against Assange in 2013, UK officials warned, "Don't you dare." Another Evilink email stated, "Please do not think this case is being dealt with as just another extradition." this and much more took place before the CIA plans exposed by Yahoo were being hashed in 2017. 2 years later, Assange was dragged by London police from the Ecuador embassy in a scenario that echoed the CIA's plan. Since then, new, even more irregular legal proceedings, either for a supposed minor bail violation or for espionage in exposing U.S. war crimes, have kept Assange indefinitely locked up in a London maximum security prison. The point here is that the idea that the CIA suddenly tried to interfere in a sound legal process against Assange is laughable. Everything about the Assange case from the outset had been extrajudicial in the sense that there has been no legal basis for proceedings. It has been legal theater. Concealing the brute force of an unaccountable superpower, angry and fearful that in the digital age, its secrets and crimes can no longer be concealed from the public. What the CIA brought to the table was not some new interest in extrajudicial vengeance. That was at the core of Assange's treatment from the outset. But the specific extrajudicial tools it excels in, such as abduction and murder.
Australia, the United Kingdom, and United States have formed a new military alliance called AUKUS. As part of this alliance, Australia will receive new missiles and a fleet of nuclear submarines built by the US and UK. Meanwhile, the United States will increase its military presence and operational capability in the region. This pact has angered France, who lost out on a contract to originally build diesel submarines for Australia. It's also been condemned by China, which views this increased militarization and buildup of foreign troops in its region as a threat. So what exactly is AUKUS? Is it really about promoting regional peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific, or part of a larger power struggle seeking to provoke China and project Western influence? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On September 15th, the Prime Ministers of Australia and the United Kingdom, Scott Morrison and Boris Johnson, along with the President of the United States, Joe Biden, issued a joint statement announcing a new military partnership between their three countries called AUKUS. As part of this trilateral